I'm talking with Jerry Pippin, a journalist who has covered the Kennedy assassination for literally 50 years. He will update us on the latest information, and also he'll be talking about and actually reviewing Larry Sabatow's latest book, The Kennedy Half Century. Sabatow had a news conference the other day. He also sent out a press packet with a poll in it that he commissioned by the Hart people, and we covered that before on a Friday Jobber, one of our programs, Boston Red programs. And also in the pre-part, we'll talk a little about the ballistic part of it involving the Dictor Belt. And you'll hear the Dictor Belt before Jerry, and then we'll get into his review of Sabatow and the facts involved there. And he will also talk about a book put out by the Secret Service agents that were there on that day. Clint Hill, the man, if you recall, he was the one that jumped off of the follow-up car and ran to the limousine and pushed Mrs. Kennedy back into the presidential limo. And the fellow that was the lead writer, Jerry Blaine, also one of the Secret Service agents that was involved, although he was sent to Austin, Texas. So those are the two, the Kennedy detail and then Sabatow's book. And as Jerry will tell you, there are hundreds of other books out there. So now we'll go on to Jerry Pippin speaking to me live from the hometown of the conservative senator who voted to not reopen the government or extend the debt ceiling, one Tom Coburn.
Okay, we're going to listen to the dictaphone and see the Larry Sabatow's book's based a lot on this dictaphone recording. And a lot of people don't even know what a dictaphone is. And basically, a dictaphone, it was a belt that ran in a machine that you set on your desk and you talked. I'm not sure why the Dallas police recorded anything on the police radio traffic on a dictaphone. There were wire recordings, and also tape was around in 1963, even though it was certainly not as easy to use as cassette recordings later. But the real tape was definitely there. So I'm not quite sure why the dictaphone is one they've been using all the time. Because as you listen here, you see the dictaphone quality is not very good at all. As you can tell, how Sabatow could decipher anything out of that dictaphone is beyond me and that recording. I've had experience with dictaphones. My partner in a radio station I owned, an FM station back in the 60s, he dictated everything to his legal secretary on a dictaphone, and she would spend literally all day sometimes trying to decipher what he had dictated. And this was quite common with secretaries around the country. As a dictaphone, he used a belt, and it certainly was not very high quality at all. Now, you had 50 years of it setting around and deteriorating a little bit, and it's a miracle that anything could be deciphered from a dictaphone. Now, I want to get into some of the Sabatow evidence and where the fallacies are. But before we do that, I think I need to get into a little background about 50 years. 50 years, we've had the same muddled confusion about the Kennedy assassination as we do almost every conspiracy. And you sometimes wonder why these things happen and play out this way, but part of it's human nature, and part of it is that the establishment at the time never really releases the full details. And we've seen that even in today's political world, that the government seems to love secrets even when they aren't secret anymore. Now, we're going to listen to a recording from C-SPAN a little later on with the two secret agents involved. And before we get to that, I'll give you a little background on that. But I think you'll find it interesting, especially when I give you the background on it. But the background really needs to, an overview would be the best way to summarize what I'm getting ready to say. And that is that it's been 50 years, and we still are no closer to a solution than ever, ever. Now, what has happened is people have been polarized into the positions. As you listen to the Secret Service men, they're willing to buy into what the Warren Commission and other reports of the official story is, and that Lee Oswald was the shooter. An interesting surprise, we're going to play the police chief of Dallas, Chief Curry, in an interview, and he tries to muddle the water even more, and I'll tell you about Chief Curry in a moment as well. But the point that I want to make here is that it looks like most of the people, the Undertaker has taken most of the players, and they're no longer around. There's no longer a witness, and the chances of us actually getting a regular, detailed report of what happened with the Kennedy assassination, with everyone believing it, after 50 years of obfuscation by not only the U.S. government, not only the Secret Service, but also by the researchers themselves. I know many of these researchers have done many interviews, and many of them are on my website at jerrypippin.com. And each one of these researchers, I think, believe what they come up with. And when you're dealing with circumstantial third-person answers, where you're looking at the notes on television and the YouTube recordings of kinescopes is what they used back in those days. The quality was very, very, very inferior. What it was they literally ran a film camera over a cathode tube, which was how television was broadcast in those days, and the quality sucked, to be blunt about it. And so we have that as well. We also have some recordings, which were pretty good, from the networks and some other places, especially the audio of these things. But here again, even the Walter Cronkite famous announcement of Kennedy being dead, when he had to take his glasses off and the tears were coming out of his eyes, even that was a kinescope. So if I'm not mistaken. So the point here I want to mention is that technology today has by far surpassed everything that existed in 1963. And in 1963, we really thought we were uptown, because I was in broadcasting before the Army, and during the Army I did some radio work. And after the Army, of course, my career really took off. But the point is that during this time, I was in the Army at the time that Kennedy was assassinated, by the way. And it was quite a shock to everyone. And no one really knew what to make of it. And they had immediately they centered in on Lee Harvey Oswald almost like magic. And the point is that Lee Harvey Oswald, later on television at the Dallas police station, said that I'm a patsy. Now, a lot of people didn't want to believe that. I'm inclined to believe it, even though if you listen to some of the interviews we're going to do with the two Secret Service men, you'll find that they are willing to buy into it, that it was Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone, and they buy into the story that he was a fellow who just couldn't pull anything off and decided that he'd kill the president to prove that he was a man to be deal with. That may be a stretch, or maybe that's true. Who knows? That's the problem. After 50 years, no one really knows anything. Now, they're going to release more official details in 2 or 3 years from now, but the fact is, the 50th anniversary, we're going to be inundated with all kinds of theories, all kinds of people preaching the gospel, according to Lee Harvey Oswald and others, with contrary theories or hypotheses. And over 100 JFK books have been written, and probably another 20 are added to it over this November period, that we're getting ready to really center in on the JFK assassination. Now, later on, our plans are to, after the assassination, and around December or so, we are going to use some recordings made of Lyndon Johnson on Air Force One flying back to Washington and all of the radio traffic that happened. And we're going to use that recording in a way to weave the story in detail. And this will be quite a serious undertaking and will take us several weeks to put it together. And as you know, I've been recuperating from illnesses, and I haven't had much time to work on it during this time, but I do plan to start in December working on it again. So I'm not through with the JFK assassination by any means, but I just want you to say the evidence shows what you want it to. You can use the evidence and pretty well convince yourself that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman. Or you can take the same evidence and take it with a viewpoint that there was a cover-up and that actually, as Lee Harvey Oswald said, he was a patsy. And a lot of very, very intelligent men with decent and really unchallenged backgrounds in journalism and investigations have come to different conclusions. And this has served to muddle the waters. But let's get back to Sabatow's book. Sabatow is a professor specializing in politics at the University of Virginia. And he has been a political commentator for some time, an analysis person. His politics lean from ever, how you want to look at it, from being the establishment voice to somewhat conservative. Now, it's interesting that he came out with this book on the 50th anniversary, and it's a big, thick book. It's a lot that I think could have been written, and a lot shorter than what he wrote. It just seems that each year they keep coming up with an establishment book that pushes the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. We had Gerald Posner's book two or three years back, which later became a little discounted, and Posner was a respected author, but he pretty well had some holes in his book, and so does Sabatow. One of the things that Sabatow insists on, because he's concentrating on the story that the Dallas police motorcycle person had his microphone stuck, and you could hear the three shots from the grassy knoll. And in addition to another shot. And Sabatow tries to debunk this, and he uses his dictaphone, which is unintelligible, really. In addition to that, he says that the motorcycle driver was 2 miles away. And he said that the motorcycle driver did not escort the presidential limousine with Kennedy, who was dead probably by then, and his wife, and they sped down underneath the underpass that got onto the expressway to go to Parkland Hospital, and he says that there was only one motorcycle. Well, Boston Red looked at the evidence, saw the videos again, he counted three motorcycles in that episode after the shots were fired and the Secret Service man jumped out of the car and got on the back of the other car and pushed Mrs. Kennedy down. And so We can discuss more of that in a moment, and we will. And we're going to play an interview from C-SPAN years ago, not that many years ago, but some time back, in which the interviewer, actually, he was the head of C-SPAN at the time, does a very good job talking to the Secret Service men. Now, one of the Secret Service men was driving the car, and many researchers and many people I've talked to over the years are convinced that he slowed down. But the car, the presidential limo, as you'll hear, was going 11 miles per hour, and it actually made a turn there just as the shots came out, and it slowed down probably to 5 or 6 miles per hour, almost to a stop. Now, a lot of people have said that that Secret Service man was in on the killing. We've heard this many times. There's another theory that there was a Secret Service man with a high-powered rifle that did it. Then we had the three shooters on the grassy knoll with several witnesses testifying to that. And so the thing is, to be kind, of all of the eyewitnesses we hear and all of the upfront evidence we hear about what Lyndon Johnson might have said later and what this was said and what was this said, is a fact that they're all contradictory, and none of it can be proven. It's he said, she said, and unfortunately, we haven't been able to nail anything down positively, 100% positive, that is. Now, I think the evidence, contrary to many people in the media, I think that there's plenty of evidence that it's probably not Lee Harvey Oswald that did the shooting. And we'll discuss that in a little bit more detail in the future shows. And the Secret Service men do address this. And there was a toll taken on those two Secret Service men. One of them ended up having a very serious drinking problem and depression. But they then recovered, and they were able to do this interview, and they wrote a book, which we talked about at the top of the show. Boston Red introduced it, and it's in great detail about how they did it. Now, I can testify in person that back then, when Kennedy was president, the Secret Service presence was minimal, because I saw JFK come to the University of California, Berkeley, one day, and he had a motorcycle, two motorcycles in front of him, a Secret Service car in the back, and he had the top down in the car, and he was waving to everybody. He could almost reach out and touch him. And, of course, that's a far cry from what's happening now, as we now are, I think, oversaturated with the evidence of security, and probably have gone a little too far, but that's only my opinion. Let's talk a little bit about, before we play this interview with the two Secret Service men, there's a theory there that we need to cover, and that is that the driver was in on it. The theories abound, and we're going to play something by Chief Curry of the Dallas Police Department. And there's some evidence, he was a right-wing conservative, and there's some evidence that he was at the home of Clint Murchison the night before, along with many other people who were Kennedy haters, including H.L. Hunt, who had a canned goods kingdom, and H.L. Hunt spent all of his money on 15-minute radio shows in the evening, where they spent all the time giving out ultra-conservative dogma, a long, long time before Rush Limbaugh, but basically it was the same approach. And it was pretended to be a regular newscast, but it was far, far from that. So everybody was at Clint Murchison's house that night, and Clint Murchison was one of those people who was an ultra-conservative as well. A John Birch Society member or two were there as well, and the rest of them were very sympathetic to the John Birch Society, including Chief Curry. Now, I bring all this up for a reason. Lyndon Johnson showed up there in the evening, I think it's about 8:45, and suddenly everybody got quiet. And Lyndon walked in and said hello to everybody and talked to this group of conservatives around the dinner table. And I knowing Lyndon Johnson, at least by reading his historical background and people who knew him well, I came to a conclusion a little different than my good friend Jim Morris did, who believes that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the assassination. I came to an opposite conclusion. My conclusion was that Lyndon wanted to go in and needle these guys, and he had gotten word as vice president, there's no secret to Secret Service and other investigators. You couldn't keep a secret with these guys. And so he went over to Clint Murchison's house and just walked in, probably to needle one. That's my opinion. Now, did Lyndon Johnson know about the assassination? I'm not so sure. A lot of people believe he did. But I think perhaps he figured it out later. He's a smart man. And he learned to keep his mouth shut over it simply because I guess the best illustration of that is a story that has a lot of documentation. People tell it for the truth that when they left Parkland Hospital to go back to Air Force One, Lyndon Johnson grabbed Jackie Kennedy and pushed her down on the floorboards and said, "They're going to kill us. They're going to try to kill us all. Stay down here." And the point is that later on, Lyndon Johnson was able to get his programs through with some help and no blockage by the conservative Republicans. And a lot of people, including myself, think that that is part of the payoff for Lyndon to keep his mouth shut later on. Now, Lyndon Johnson had worked all his life to get the poverty program, get the war on poverty, get Medicare, and several other programs through the Great Society, as we learned to identify it. And Lyndon Johnson broke all kinds of records. Now, he was very good at taking an enemy on the political front, a conservative Republican, walking right up to him, looking them in the eye, grabbing them by the lapels, and telling them what he wanted done. And he got his way a lot because he yielded a lot of power. And interestingly enough, Lyndon Johnson did not run for a second term, and I think that's because he was sick and tired of the Vietnam War, but he couldn't really say much about it because he was instrumental in getting us involved there. And that was part of the military-industrial complex's bargain with Lyndon Johnson, in my opinion. And the reason I judge this is I find the real reason for the assassination of JFK is not only that you had a perfect storm, he'd already had the Bay of Pigs, and the CIA was upset with him. They pretty well had taken, talking about Kennedy, had taken the authority away from them. In addition to that, he had given Grumman Aviation, an upstart company, a huge fighter contract. And in addition to that, Boeing and the others were just terrified that Kennedy was going to be a loose cannon and not play ball with the military-industrial complex. In fact, Kennedy was already making some noise about getting our special advisors out of Vietnam, even though the military-industrial complex evidently had planned to use this to get a big bankroll from the Uncle Sam, from the U.S. government, as they fought a war on and on and on. And, of course, we know the history. That's the way it played out. Now, what they were afraid of down in Texas, and this is the reason I say that I named all of those players that were Clint Murchison's house, is that Kennedy is going to spend a fortune by those terms in those days on putting a man on the moon in a decade. And the aviation companies could, the aerospace companies could feel and taste the money coming in, as there would be no really limit on the expenditures, because we are in a race for the moon with Russia, or at least it was portrayed that way. And remember, Russia had got into space before we did with Sputnik. So everybody was on edge, and everybody in Texas and the aviation companies were afraid that what Kennedy was going to do was move NASA, which was on the drawing board at that time, to Boston and away from Texas. And so the what better way than Lyndon Johnson, who was the vice president, would be more inclined to keep all of the money down in Texas, which he did. And we all know that NASA ended up in Houston. So I think this is one of the major reasons for the assassination, and that's money. And, of course, there were other enemies of JFK. If you think the right wing is bitter now, back in those days, when the John Birch Society was there, Kennedy was the biggest demon that ever lived, according to these people, even though by the general population he was a popular president, and the people loved him, and loved Jackie and the entire Camelot regime there in Washington, D.C. So let's listen now to this interview with the Secret Service men. Remember, one of them was the driver, and many researchers believe he was involved. They believe that he slowed the car down slow enough that shots could be fired. Now, we also have an interview with Chief Curry, who was a right-winger, but he kind of muddles the water. And remember, that's how, and we still do it today, that's how we obfuscate things and get facts covered up, is you get people who you think are guilty, all of a sudden they come up almost agreeing with you a couple of times. And Curry mentions a possibility of another shooter in this interview. It's all very, very strange. And it's been strange for 50 years. And I submit to you, before we go to the tape, that it's strange that you could not solve this murder, and that's what it was. We dress it up as an assassination, but it was a murder of the president, and a lot of evidence, but somehow we just never really got to the bottom of it. We have two competing theories. Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Lee Harvey Oswald didn't do it. And that's kind of where it is 50 years later. Just unbelievable. I've come to the conclusion that we probably won't prosecute anybody, even if we found out that there was a conspiracy to commit murder on the President of the United States. Listen now to these sound bites.
There's a possibility that one could have come from in front of us. We've never been able to prove that. But just in my mind, and by the direction of the blood and brain from the president from one of the shots, it would just seem that it would have to be fired from the front rather than behind. I can't say that I could swear that I believe there was one man and one man alone. I think that there's a possibility there could have been another man.
Driver of the car, Bill Greer, was running the presidential vehicle closer to the left-hand side of the street to keep the president, who was in the right rear, away from the crowd on the right. Well, that put Mrs. Kennedy right next to the crowd, and the motorcycles would have to drop back. So I occasionally, down Main Street, would go from the follow-up car, get up on the back of the car.
What was your job during this trip?
I was responsible for Mrs. Kennedy's protection. And I did that four or five times until we got to the end of Main Street. When we turned right onto Houston, the crowds dissipated. There were very few people. And so I got back in the follow-up car. When we turned left on Elm, right in front of the school book depository, there were very few people on the left. few people on the right. There was no reason to be on the back of the car, and we knew we were about to hit the Stebbins Freeway and Expressway, and we were going to go at freeway speeds, which meant there wouldn't be agents on the back of the car anyway. So there were no agents on the back of the car at the time the incident occurred, but it was partly because we were about to hit a freeway and partly because he didn't want them there.
Joe Blaine, what was your job?
My job at that time, after I came back from Tampa, I was supposed to go to Dallas to help Wynn Lawson complete the advance. But we had an agent who had some connections in Dallas, so I joined the midnight shift. And we worked from midnight to 8 and in the White House, and then we caught a twin-engine Navy plane and flew to Fort Worth and stood watch that night. The next day when the assassination occurred, we just arrived in Austin, Texas.
So. And were you just on the detail, on the presidential detail, or were you running? I mean, what was your title?
I was a special agent on the detail. I'd been on the detail for 5 years. Like Clint, I'd started with President Eisenhower.
How long did you work for the Secret Service?
It was just a little over 5 years when
total.
I left, yes.
Clint Hill, how long did you work for the Secret Service?
17 and a half years.
And why did you leave?
I was forced to leave because of retirement, disability retirement.
Do I remember correctly that you were 43 at the time? When
That's
you left?
Correct. I was 43 when they retired me.
What have you done since then?
Mostly just been retired. I tried a few businesses which didn't succeed.
From that day, I would say there are about 17 that are still alive of the people that worked on the Kennedy detail from 1961 on.
How many total would have been on the detail?
Well, at any one time, there were 34 agents on the president's detail and 6 agents on Mrs. Kennedy and the children's detail.
Now, we've got some video from YouTube. One of the things you say in your book that made you want to write this book was all the conspiracy theories, and you talked about the movie from Oliver Stone. This is a man named Vince Palamara.
Oh.
Do you know him?
I'm familiar with him. I don't know him.
He says that, I guess, that, and we'll talk about this, that he sent you a 22-page letter.
I recall receiving a letter which I sent back to him. I didn't bother with it.
You didn't talk to him ever?
He called me, and I said hello, but that was about it.
And over the years, have you both been called about this assassination on many occasions?
I've been called numerous times.
What's been your attitude? How have you approached people? That
for the most part, I've just said I have no comment. I just have nothing to say.
And why is that?
Well, most of it's from people who are writing conspiracy theory books that don't make any sense to me. So if they're not going to deal in fact, then I don't want anything to do with it.
And how about you? What have you been?
Same thing. I have never talked to an author of a book. And I just felt we have it on our commission books, worthy of trust and confidence. And I felt those were issues that you should never talk to anybody on the outside about. And it was, I had to weigh and evaluate when I wrote this book because I felt I wasn't talking about the Secret Service. I wasn't talking about the Kennedy family. But I was talking about the agents that I worked with and the incidents that occurred. And those were my friends, so that's when I decided to write.
Did you have to get permission to do this from the Secret Service?
No.
So this wasn't cleared by the Secret Service?
No.
Okay. No, but we had lunch today with the director of the Secret Service, who thanked us very much for our contribution. So.
Here is this video. It's not very long, and this man's name is Vince Palamara. He's a citizen who has taken it on his own to become an expert. He's from Pennsylvania, and I don't know him. I've never talked to him. I've just seen it on the web, and I believe he's a graduate of Duquesne University. So let's watch this, and I'll get your reaction to it.
Hi, this is Vince Palamara, the self-described Secret Service expert that Jerry Blaine accuses me of without naming me, okay? Back with my obsession about the Kennedy detail. I gotta read this. This is rich. Page 287. This is what Blaine's claiming Raleigh said. Raleigh turned to Jerry Blaine, and Jerry, since you were in the lead car, did you ever hear this over your radio as well? Yes, sir, I did. I heard exactly what Floyd just told you. The thing about this is the whole thing about the Ivy League charlatans thing. Jerry Blaine told me the Ivy League charlatans thing came from the guys. I can't remember who said it. Boy, his memory got real good 5 years later, because now he's claiming he heard it over the radio, Floyd Boring, okay? Just unbelievable. It's just amazing to me, you know? There never would have been a book if I didn't send a 22-page letter, okay?
Plus, at the time. Fascinating. All right. Let's see. And I wanted to make one point. We're here because of a very sad event, but we don't want to make this a sad occasion. I'd like to pass on to you a story that came to me while I was about halfway through the book. It did not occur to me until I read a passage in the book. Now, let me take you back to Denver, Colorado, and both Jerry and Clint worked in the Denver office of the Secret Service, but not at this time. In 1963, I think it was, I saw President Kennedy. And at the time, we lived next door to one of the top executives at the local Lincoln Mercury dealer. And he came over one day and told my dad and I, said, President Kennedy's coming to town, and we're going to service his limousine. He's going to come right by here. We just lived a block away from a major east-west street. And I know when they're coming by. If you go out there on 6th Avenue, you'll be able to see him and wave to him. So I went out there. And, you know, there's no one else there because the route that he was taking from, I think, Lowry Air Force Base to downtown Denver was not published. So I'm the only one out there. And I saw the flashing lights and all, and here comes the big limousine. I'm sitting there waving. And he went right by. He never saw me. He had his head down. He was reading something. It occurred to me reading this book that there were Secret Service agents in that car wondering, hey, how did that guy know? And who else knows? There's probably something in the file somewhere that says, find out about that kid. All right. Your book, The Kennedy Detail, is getting an awful lot of attention. And one of the stories that's been talked about a lot is the moment when you, Jerry, almost gunned down the brand new president of the United States, Lyndon Johnson. You were at the White House. Take it from there. What happened?
Well, I wasn't at the White House. This was about 2:15 in the morning after the assassination, and we were all Kennedy detail agents that were standing watch. And President Kennedy, if he came outside, he would notify the security command post, and we'd get the word around that the president was out moving. The vice president, before he became president, usually only had about two agents with him. One would be inside and maybe the other one out. And so he had no idea the protocol. And I hadn't slept in about 40 hours. And I was hallucinating. And when I relieved the 4 to 12 shift agent, he was still just emotionally wrought from Dallas, and so he pointed to the Thompson submachine gun that we had on post, and so we placed them all there, and not knowing whether it was a conspiracy or not, we were pretty much on edge when I heard a noise coming from around the house, and all of a sudden I had my weapon to my shoulder, my finger on the trigger, and I don't know if you notice it, but you can recognize Lyndon Johnson's profile, so fortunately I noticed that right away. So, but it was close. I had nightmares over that for a long time afterwards.
Those of you who've been here before know where we are, but of course the C-SPAN viewers might not know. We're actually on the 7th floor of what used to be the Texas School Book Depository building. The building's now owned by Dallas County. It's the Dallas County Administration Building. The museum has exhibits on the 6th floor and on the 7th floor, and we're in a separate area. It's a Saturday afternoon. In 2 days, it will have been 47 years since President Kennedy was killed, right outside of these windows. Jerry and Lisa, where has this book been, and why has it taken so long for the story from you guys to come out?
Let me start with the motivation first. when I retired, I started looking on the internet and started reading stories about agents that we had served with that were accused of being a part of a conspiracy. The driver turning around and shooting President Kennedy, although if you look close, this is Kennedy in the back of the head in order to get to the president at that time. And just stories that were defaming the people. And so I read a story that involved Tampa where I'd conducted an advance, and I went back and looked at my records, and I said, it's time to set the record straight. There are not many of us left, and we're all gray-haired, and we won't be around very long. So we wanted to leave a record. And to find somebody, I must have written probably about 7 books and stories, but to find somebody that could put the heart and soul to the book, Lisa McCubbin, who wasn't even boring at the time of the assassination, but with Joyce, my wife, and I were friends with her parents, and she graduated with my son from high school. So Lisa, in the course of this, became an agent, and I think I'll let her discuss her feelings as she put this together with me. So.
You want me to talk about
sure.
that a little bit?
Sure.
Well, first of all, it's been an honor and a privilege to have been involved in this project. I feel extremely lucky that somehow the stars aligned and Jerry and I have known each other for all these years, and it was the right time, and we came together to work on this project. And it has been just fascinating for me because I was born in January of 1964, and you know, in history class, it seems like when you take U.S. history in your junior year of high school, you get to about World War II, and it's May, and things are winding down. And I had never studied the Kennedy assassination. You know, of course, I knew of it, but didn't know much about it. What I knew was that when I used to go to the Blaine's house for Christmas Eve, they always had a great Christmas Eve party. Down in their basement, they had these great photographs of Jerry with Lyndon Johnson and Eisenhower and Kennedy, and I was always fascinated by that. But being 12 years old at the time, or 16 years old, I didn't ever really feel comfortable asking him about it. So working on this book, I feel like I got a rare window into history like no one else has.
Was this your first book? I know you've been a journalist for much of your professional life. Was this
yes,
your first book?
This is my first published book.
As I read through the book, I could tell where you were leading me, and sometimes when you read books like that, I mean, you don't, it's kind of annoying. But with your book, I was enjoying getting there. I knew what you were leading to, and an emotional moment, and it was enjoyable to follow along with how that trail wound around. How did you decide to write the book in the way you did?
Well, as Jerry said, he had spent many years putting stories together, and he had contacted a lot of the agents already, so I had a lot of material to work with in terms of all of their various stories, and we came up with the idea together of how to put the story together. And to me, what was really fascinating and was important in this book was to show these men as human beings, not just these nameless, faceless men in dark sunglasses. To me, the Secret Service agents were always very mysterious creatures. And, you know, as I've gotten to know them, I realized they're human beings. And the stories that I read from the various agents and as I started interviewing the agents were just so poignant that to me it was really important to make the reader understand who these men were and to love them and to understand the close relationship they had with the Kennedys, so that you know what's going to happen in the book. Everybody knows what's going to happen, but you kind of want to know where, you know, now you start caring about Jerry Blaine, and you want to know, well, where is he going to be when this happens? And so I wanted to kind of build that drama into it.
Clint, you were somewhat reluctant to get involved. You've appeared very few times over the years, more so than most of the other agents, though, but how did you get involved in this book, and how did Jerry talk you into it?
Well, I've known Jerry since 1959. He
actually replaced me in Denver when I got transferred to the White House. And he called me one day and asked me if I'd be willing to contribute to a book he was writing. And he told me what it was going to be about, and I was not enthusiastic at all. I was very apprehensive about it because I'd been offered many chances to write books, contribute to books, appear on television, various things, and I just didn't want to do it. So then he told me that this book was going to be factual, no salacious information, no gossip, that the information would be coming from the agents that were involved and material that they had. And then he said that I could check it for fact. Once he said that, then I agreed to contribute, as long as I could check it before it was published, which I did, and I've read the book 6 times, and I know what's in it, and it's factual, not fiction.
You mentioned salacious material, and some of the Kennedy legacy is the talk about his personal life. And there's not a whole lot of that in your book. Why is that?
We in the Secret Service give the president and his family as much privacy as we can. When they get to the second floor of the White House, that's where they live. We stay out of there unless we have to go there or requested to go there. What happens on the second floor, that's their business, not ours. Same thing goes when they're in residence away from the White House. We provide them with an environment in which they can function safely, but they live their lives as they want to live them. We don't interfere. And we don't talk about it. Mm-hmm.
For several months following the assassination, you continued with your assignment, which was Jackie Kennedy. At some point, did people come up to you, like after that Life magazine came out with frames from the Zapruder film where they could see you running up to the car, did they come up to you and say, are you that guy? Did that happen?
Rarely, because I tried to make sure nobody knew who I was, but I stayed with Mrs. Kennedy and the children for a full year after the assassination until November of 1964, and then I was returned to the White House detail.
Did that make it easier or harder to deal with what had happened, that personal relationship with Jackie?
It made it more difficult because I had to go through the grieving process with the family, with she and the children. Christmas of 64 was an absolute horror because here we are with these 2 young children who just lost their father and the widow who just lost her husband, and you're trying to make it as merry a Christmas as you can, but it's just impossible.
Did you two stay in touch after that?
When I left in 1964, they threw a going away party for me in New York where she was living at the time. She had moved to New York and I lived in a hotel room in New York, and they wished me well. They thought I was being transferred to Muddy Gap, Wyoming, because they thought for sure they'd never let me back on the White House detail, having been with the Kennedys. I saw her in 1968 for the funeral of Senator Robert Kennedy, and I've talked to her a few times on the telephone because of interest she had in protective activities surrounding her children, and that was the extent of it.
All three of you, I assume, spoke with many of the current and former agents at the time about this project. How did those conversations go, and what kind of responses did you get, especially from those who would not speak or participate in this project?
Well, I started off really by calling Jerry Bain's wife, and Jerry had passed on, and he was our agent in charge, and I talked with her and told her that I was thinking of doing that. The second person I touched base with was Floyd Boring. Surprising probably to many of you, but we never discussed the assassination with each other. After the assassination occurred, there was no trauma counseling. There was just an awful lot of work to do. So we were left to do the work, and our working life was 60 hours a month overtime on average. I think I calculated it out. We made about $1.80 an hour, and we just were constantly working. And you'd work, and the only way you could relax is take an hour or two after you got off and spend time relaxing or drowning down with the with the agent you were working with. And so we just somehow kind of swallowed our emotions. We got wrapped up in the new president, and we had no idea what impact it was going to have on us the rest of our life. But there were two agents that I talked to, but they told me they didn't want to participate. And one was Jack Reedy, and I have a great deal of empathy for Jack Reedy because he was on the president's side of the automobile. And when he heard the first retort, he turned around and looked up from where the shot came from. And Clint, he'll explain later, as his eyes scanned over, he noticed the president's hands go to his throat. And so Clint took off immediately. And Jack then turned around and, you know, for all of his might, he wanted to jump off the car. But the follow-up car driver had pulled over. Had Jack even attempted to make it, he'd have been run over by the car. But then there was a movie, and Hollywood has played a big impact on all of us. In The Line of Fire, they had Clint Eastwood's figure pasted in where Jack Reedy was on the follow-up car. And the theme of the movie was that he failed miserably at his job. And that was the theme of the movie. I'm speculating, but I think that's probably what impacted Jack. And he just said emotionally he couldn't participate. A second agent, Don Lawton, who was assigned to do the departure advance here in Dallas. And we were so stripped down of agents on this trip, that'll probably be another question. But Don was a senior agent, and you needed a senior agent to handle a departure. So he was left behind. You may have seen movies that some of the theorists say he was being told to stand down. Don was just getting his turn to run by the car, and he knew he was going to have to stay there. But not being able to be with the president in Dallas that day really impacted him.
One of the things that comes out very clearly in the book is the day-to-day routine of the agents. Endless hours, day in and day out, of just standing and watching. And how do you do a job like that?
Well, sometimes you're looking off into black water out there somewhere saying, geez, what did I waste my 4 years going to college for? But the rest of the time, we did it. You know, our agents were pre-technology. We used hand signals with each other. We had no radio communication. We had 3x5 cards with photographs of people who had threatened the president, and on the back of the 3x5 card, we had their biography and so forth. And we would memorize those pictures, and then people would always ask us why we wore sunglasses, because behind the sunglasses, your eyes can look right and left, and so if you see one of the individuals, then you bang on the side of the car, and the other agents do that, and you do a quick turn over that way. They've got their eye on him, and if you feel a threat there, then you notify the driver to move on. But that was our technology. So
is it okay for the general public to know that now?
We had a budget, I think, in 1963 of $4.5 million. I don't think we had that much, but we had probably 330 agents. There were 34 of us on the White House detail. There were two agents on the First Lady and three agents on the children. And today they have a budget, I'll go conservative, $1.4 billion, and they have somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,500 agents and 7,000 employees, isn't it, the organization. So it's an altogether different game today. But the weaponry is much better, too. When you get sniper rifles that can do headshots at a mile away, and some of the other technologies and larger groups that use suicide to as a weapon, then you've still got a serious problem. But I'm positive the agents today have the same heart and soul we do. So
the business is so much more complicated now. That makes me wonder, did you have to show the manuscript to the Secret Service before it went to the publisher?
Then why don't you take one, we'll talk about the director.
No, they didn't have to receive approval for this at all from the Secret Service. However, we did, Jerry allowed me to take a book and talk to the director, Mark Sullivan, about it. And he read the book, and he called me up, and he was very enthusiastic about the book. And he invited us to come to his office and have a luncheon with him last Monday, which everybody did. And he indicated that he thought the contents of the book should be read by every new agent in the service because it would help them understand exactly what had happened in the past, and they could use that information in what they're doing today.
And I might add to that, Clint did notify Director Sullivan while we were writing the book. He wanted to let him know that it was being done. And at first, he was... What did he say?
He said, oh, no, not another book.
And but then he said he found out that Clint was involved, and he said, if Clint Hill's involved, we don't have a problem with it. We know it's going to be worthy of trust and confidence.
Can't get much better than that. Jerry, after you left the service, you did mostly security work, but you lived for a while here in the Dallas area. Were you here when word first got out that there was going to be a museum about the Kennedy assassination here in town?
No, I worked for IBM for 27 years. I started, I left in July of 1964, and I ended up working on law enforcement and intelligence systems and helped design the FBI National Crime Information Center, the Walnut system for the CIA, and mobile terminals, fingerprint scanners. My frustration, and I think one of the reasons I left, was it almost seemed like a futile job unless we had the type of equipment needed. So I worked quite a while on that, and so I made a call on the Secret Service because the FBI system could check for wanted people, and we had no way of keeping track of where these potential threat cases were. And so they had a new data processing manager at the Secret Service, and so I said, well, why don't you just tie into the National Crime Information Center and run the inquiries through, and if you get a hit, at least you'll know where they are. And he said, well, gee, that would be an invasion of privacy. And after going through the assassination, I just couldn't take that. So I went into the security side of IBM. And here in Dallas, I worked for ARCO International. And you already had the museum up and running pretty well then. So.
And Clint, you stayed with the service for a while. But then you retired and dealt with your personal situation.
Correct.
What's kept you busy since then?
Well, I tried a number of businesses. None of them worked, but I was a failure at all of them. So I've just kept busy with my family. That's about the only thing I've been able to do recently. But I did stay with the service. I was returned to the White House detail in 1964, and I was assigned to then-President Johnson. The first thing that happened was... President Johnson went to his ranch, Stonewall, Texas, and I was down there, and one day I was walking between the house and the security room, and President Johnson saw me. He recognized me as having been on the Kennedy detail. I had met him personally in New York. He came to visit Mrs. Kennedy one day at the Carlisle Hotel, so he knew who I was, and as soon as he saw me, he called and talked to the agent in charge, Rufus Youngblood, and said that he wanted me removed immediately, didn't want me to be assigned to that detail with him because I'd been with the Kennedys, and he thought for sure I was a Kennedy loyalist. So Mr. Youngblood went in and talked to him. And after about 30 minutes, he convinced him that I should stay. And so I stayed, and eventually, within 3 years, I became the agent in charge of his protection. And when he left office, he asked me if I'd be willing to come down to his ranch and run his protective detail, and I told him I didn't think my career ladder should end at the Pertinalis River, so he accepted my denial of going down there to take that job, and I went on to be the agent in charge of vice president protection, then moved to headquarters, and they eventually promoted me to assistant director for all protection, and then I was retired in 1975.
In 1975, that was the interview on one of the earliest episodes, or earliest 60 Minutes programs, and you got a phone call at one point, and I know this is in detail in the book, but this was a moment when you first talked on camera about the Kennedy assassination, and people have remembered it ever since. Of course, now it's on YouTube everywhere. Do people ask you a lot about that appearance, and what do you tell them about that moment?
Well, they do ask me about it because it was one of those situations where I completely broke emotionally. 60 Minutes actually did the taping twice. The first time they taped it, everything went fine. When they got back to New York, apparently, Don Hewitt, who ran 60 Minutes, didn't like the way they did it because they didn't get into my emotions enough. And so Mike Wallace called me up and said, hey, we have some technical problems with that thing. We're going to have to shoot it again. And so I met him for lunch at a hotel in Washington, and they shot it again. And this time the questions were quite different than they were the first time. And he got right into my emotional baggage, and I broke on camera. Many times people have asked me about that, and
sure,
if I've recovered. And yes, I can say I have. But actually, it was cathartic that that happened. I'm glad that it happened the way it did, because that was the first time I ever really let loose of any of that emotional baggage that I had stored inside me.
And you had another moment when you and your wife came back to Dealey Plaza.
In 1990, the agents have an organization called the Association of Former Agents of the U.S. Secret Service, held a conference in San Antonio, and my wife and I decided to go to that. And I decided that since we were in the Dallas area, I didn't tell anybody this, but that we were going to go to Dallas from San Antonio, and I was coming to Dealey Plaza. I had not been here since the assassination in 1963. So we came to Dealey Plaza, and I spent some time walking Houston to Elm, observing all the angles, looking at the trees, how much they'd grown, what was different between 1963 and 1990, looking at the way the school book depository was situated in relation to the streets, came up into the sixth floor. You had just opened it as a museum at that time, and looked out the window to see what the view was and realized how close it was. It was a very easy shot, and I came away realizing that I did what I could that day, that I couldn't have done any more, and that it was a sense of relief to me to know that I had done everything I could have done.
You heard three shots.
Three shots, all came from the same location.
Evenly spaced or different?
No, I didn't hear the second shot, mm-hmm. So I only heard two shots. First shot came from my right rear, and I was looking to the left, to the grassy area on the left-hand side of Elm Street. When I heard the shot, my vision took me to the right toward that shot. In so doing, my eyes went across the back of the president's car. I saw him grab at his throat, and he started to lurch to his left. Didn't move too far, but he started going to his left. I knew something was wrong, so I jumped off the car and started to run for the presidential car, trying to get there in time to get up on top to cover, because what we tried to do was cover and evacuate. And I was trying to get there to cover up so that nobody could do any further damage to the president or to Mrs. Kennedy. About the time I got to the car, just before I got there, the third shot I heard, and I felt, because it hit the president in the head just above the right ear, right up in here, and blood and brain matter was spewing all over the place, including on me. About that time, Mrs. Kennedy came out of her seat, under the trunk of the rear of the car. She was trying to retrieve something that had come off the president's head and went to the right rear. I slipped at first trying to get onto the car because Bill Greer, the driver, accelerated the car. I gained my footing again, got up in the car, helped her get back into her seat. When I did that, the president fell over to his left into her lap, and I could see the upper right portion of his head, a large hole about the size of my palm. Looked like somebody had taken a scoop and removed brain matter, just thrown it around the car, and there was blood and brain matter and bone particles all over the car. His eyes were fixed. I was quite sure it was a fatal wound. I turned to the follow-up car and gave them a thumbs down to let them know it was a dire situation. The driver accelerated the car. We were going towards Stemmons Freeway. We got up alongside and just passed the lead car, which was being driven by Chief Curry, chief of the Dallas Police. The advance agent was in the car with him, and we were screaming at him to get us to a hospital. And he did that. He got in front of the car and led us to the nearest hospital, which turned out to be Parkland.
From the book and from some of the interviews that I've seen, you were convinced that there were three shots. One hit the president, one hit Governor Connally, and the third shot hit and killed President Kennedy.
That's correct.
Now, you know that is contradicted by the Warren Commission. They concluded that that first shot hit Kennedy and Connally. Second shot missed and struck near a bystander, and the third shot killed him.
I recognize that, but two of us believe that the second shot hit the Governor Connally. The other person who believes that is Nellie Connally, who was sitting right beside him when he was hit. So I think I'm pretty good company in believing that the second shot hit the governor, and the third shot was a fatal wound to the president.
I believe there were two mistakes that the Warren Commission made. That they did not call Sam Kinney, who was the driver of the follow-up car, or Emory Roberts, the shift leader, because Sam Kinney had to keep his eye constantly on the presidential limousine. And Sam saw all three shots find their mark. And Emory saw all three shots find their mark. Unfortunately, they weren't asked to testify.
Lisa, it must have been amazingly difficult keeping up with facts like these and trying to separate facts from some of the silly stories that are out there. How did you do it?
It was a lot of long days. Jerry and I talked about this a lot because I'd read something or read reports, and I'd say, Jerry, this contradicts what you're telling me or what Clint is telling me. And I came to realize that these were the guys that were there. And their memories are so vivid and so clear. And as I would talk to other agents, they would corroborate the stories. And I realized that this is the truth. Mm-hmm. And the other people that are writing these other reports and all these researchers that have studied this endlessly, they weren't there. And, you know, so you can take some of what is written, but what I believe is what these men have told me to be true.
I promised that we'd do a Q&A. I've got a bunch of the questions already. If you still need to fill out one of the cards, please do so. If you need something to write with, hold up your hand and our people will come by. Now, here's an interesting one. This is a tough one. This is for Jerry. You're spending so much time promoting the book, so how's your golf game coming?
About the same as it was before I started promoting it. As Walt can tell you, it's not that good. So.
if you folks are 99% certain that there was no conspiracy, what might that 1% be?
Well, no, I'd say 100%. I think any good investigator realizes that a conspiracy where one or more people or two or more people participate in a crime, it lasts probably 60 days at most. It's been 47 years, and there has been no evidence whatsoever of a conspiracy that has been proven, no proven facts. There is a lot of speculation, but then they just ignore the facts. I've gone through all the volumes of the Warren Commission and read through, and I have not found anything. I felt a real injustice was made when the House Select Committee on Assassination studied and investigated a number of the conspiracies, and they finally said, well, we could find no evidence of a conspiracy. However, we feel there was.
This has been our first blush report to try to get ahead of the crowd on the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. In the coming weeks, you'll be saturated with theories and counter theories about who did it, why they did it, who was involved, how did it really happen. And all of them will be able to present some sort of evidence. So I've tried to cut through the chaff, so to speak, and present the players, some of the people who are actually involved as the Secret Service men who were involved. In addition to that, we talked about Larry Sabato's book and how there are errors in it, and played you a little bit of the dictaphone to give you an idea of you know, how difficult it would be to really figure out anything from that. There are many, many other theories, many other shows that I have done over the past about the JFK assassination. All you have to do is go to jerrypippin.com, click on the conspiracy button, and you'll see a JFK assassination index, and we have several shows on demand, MP3 podcasts, et cetera, as well as Windows Media versions of the shows on demand for regular computer users. So we urge you to do that. And Boston Red has done a tremendous job on his Brad Gulch show about it, and he has future plans on covering this a little more in detail. But first of all, we wanted to get this show out, get ahead of the crowd, then you enjoy as much as you can take, and then we'll be back in December wrapping it up a little bit more and adding a new version of an in-depth show, which will take several weeks to unveil at jerrypippin.com. Thanks for listening. Boston Red has been the producer. I'm Jerry Pippin.